Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, and good to see everyone here in the Old Theatre in person, and also welcome to those who are watching online. So I'm Sonia Livingstone. I'm from the Department of Media and Communications here at LSE. This year, together with the Five Rights Foundation, we established the Digital Futures of Children, the Digital Futures for Children Centre, to research the opportunities for and barriers to a rights-respecting digital world. It's a pleasure to have a chance to discuss the work and the ideas in this lecture this evening. The DFC supports an evidence base for advocacy. It facilitates dialogue between academics and policymakers, and it amplifies children's voices following the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child's General Comment Number 25. And you might ask, what is that? And actually, I'll tell you that's when I first met our speaker, Baroness Kidron. We began working together about 7 years ago when we were supporting the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child in developing an authoritative statement on how children's rights apply online as well as offline. And General Comment 25 sets out a roadmap for how governments could and should take action to realise children's rights in relation to the digital environment. So we did that, and then we asked ourselves what next, and we developed what we call the Digital Futures Commission, which ran very successfully for 3 years and led to the centre that we have established now at LSE. We wanted to bring a child rights focus to lively ongoing debates about internet governance, often headlined as, problematically headlined as, bringing big tech to heel, or, as we see today, banning children from accessing this, that, or the other. We wanted to think about ways of reshaping internet governance that could encompass not only the very important hygiene factors of safety and security, but to think about the full range of rights. And we agreed that this responsibility lies first and foremost with governments and companies, the purpose being to empower but not to unduly burden people in their daily lives, coping alone with the opaque and unaccountable technological systems and business models that increasingly provide the infrastructure for all of our lives. So we asked, what could good look like? How can we learn from people's everyday experiences to better design the internet with human rights, especially child rights, in mind? And being a social scientist, I'm intrigued what insights and what evidence can support advocacy to this end. The first year of our centre has been busy, so I invite you to visit the website at digitalfuturesforchildren.net. And recently we published research on the impact of regulation on children's lives, which showed government action can lead to companies making meaningful changes to their digital products and services. But as we're going to hear tonight, there is very much more needed. But now we're facing the next challenge. As we said in the invitation to this lecture, AI is poised to supercharge its impact on almost every aspect of economic, public, and personal lives. AI might have been decades in the making, but only now are minds fully focused on managing its likely impact and mitigating the risks for families, for the public, for all of us. So, that was my intro to the centre that is hosting today's event. Before we proceed, I just want to thank the Five Rights Foundation, the Department of Media and Communications, and the DFC team for the hard work that has gone into the centre and into making tonight possible. And I want to now introduce our speaker. Baroness Beban Kidron, OBE, is a leading voice in children's rights in the digital environment and a global authority on digital regulation and accountability. She's played a decisive role in establishing standards for online safety and privacy internationally as founder and chair of the Five Rights Foundation and as a crossbench peer in the House of Lords. She's also an advisor to the Institute for Ethics in AI at Oxford, a commissioner on the UN Broadband Commission for Sustainable Development, on the UN Secretary General's high-level advisory body on artificial intelligence, and a visiting professor of practice here at LSE. Before she takes the floor, let me just say she'll speak for about 40 minutes and then we'll have time for questions and for Q&A. So be ready when the time comes, and if you're watching online, please use the Q&A function at the top of your screen. We'll conclude by 8 p.m. and for those here in person, there's going to be a reception afterwards for more informal discussion just outside this room and to the left. So, tech tantrums when tech meets humanity. It's my great pleasure to invite Yuval to give a lecture.
Thank you, Sonia, and can I also thank those of you who've come in person and the people online. Some of you must have got up very early when I saw who was coming. Thank you very much for being here and for listening in. So, a tech tantrum normally is when a child or adolescent loses it as the parent tries to prise a machine out of their hands. But the tantrums of this particular lecture are not about children attached to their devices. It's about the tantrums of the tech sector when they're told they too must play by society's rules. Tantrums of this kind reveal a sector that masks its power in bright colours and improbable names that offer convenience and entertainment, but in doing so, seek our data and seek control. And it is a sector that has fought relentlessly to remain unimpeded by the rules that contain other industries or require them to hold to societal agreements and norms, often referred to as tech exceptionality. In between tantrums, I will talk about AI and make the argument for society setting the rules for its development and governance. Because as the quote goes, if the definition of insanity is doing the same thing twice and expecting a different result, then clearly we are collectively insane. Insane to once again allow the innovation of powerful technology to rip through society without deciding first which bits of our private and public lives are precious to us or need to be in public hands. Several decades of tech exceptionalism have disproportionately privatized the benefits and outsourced its costs, or negative externalities, as the industry prefers to call them. Costs to the well-being of children, costs to social cohesion, cost of disinformation, cost of competition, and of course, opportunity cost, as we all spend our time attached firmly to our devices. And yet it seems that we are greeting the onward march towards an AI-enabled world without laying down the rules of engagement, even as our failure to contain the tech sector plays out in our communities, businesses, even on the bodies of our children. What's happening in plain sight, in small increments, is huge. Some would say existential. And yet the tech tantrums, which I'm going to recount, are part of a relentless, orchestrated, and successful campaign to maintain tech exceptionalism, even as the cost of what has gone before mounts up and the pace at which AI is developing suggests that we must act urgently. Tech tantrum one, the bullying task force. In 2016, I served on an online bullying task force, more than two dozen people, half of whom worked at tech companies. Toward the beginning, on behalf of the task force, I ran a workshop with children, something I've done dozens of times and still do. The young people, predictably thoughtful, came out of the day-long workshop with two lists. The first was a list of the responsibilities they thought fell to them, such as thinking twice before posting, calling out people who were bullying, or trying to support the bullied. The second was a list of design features and corporate behaviors that they thought tech companies should adopt to discourage the spread of bullying. Over many weeks, the tech companies huddled together, agreeing to disagree with the children. After 15 months, they agreed to publish and publicize the recommendations of how children should behave online. True to form, they were asking the children to manage the negative externalities of their poorly designed products. So I laid an amendment to a bill passing through Parliament that codified the children's arts in the form of the age-appropriate design code. And at the next task force meeting, even before we got to the agenda, a tech representative made an extraordinary ad hominem attack, the vitriol of which was overwhelming. His tantrum can be summarized as, "How dare you? We are global players. We make the rules. You will never, never dictate the terms for us from a small town in the north of England." The last being a reference to the fact that the data regulator's head office was in Wimslow, near Manchester. He also had quite a lot to say about the relative talents of those in Silicon Valley and those in the UK Parliament. In the shocked silence that followed his outburst, I picked up a piece of paper and read out loud the list of changes that the children had asked the companies to make. Uphold your own terms and conditions. Send replies to children's reports to say what action you took. Take down material that's been flagged until you can work out what's going on. Check our age before you send us pornography. Don't recommend hurtful material. Turn off live locations so we can't be tracked. Stop unknown adults contacting us. Make it easy to block bullies. Put information in language or videos in a manner that we can understand. Modest, sensible changes that did not take children out of the digital world, but ensured that it was designed with them in mind. Many in that room, previously strong advocates of self-regulation, were deeply offended by the willful disregard for children's well-being shown over many, many months, and further horrified at the hubris of claiming that the tech sector was above the law. And almost without exception, those that did not work for a tech company concluded only mandatory rules would suffice, and they all put their weight behind the code. Now, somewhere in my office, I have the list, and I'm really proud to say that each of the young people's asks is now codified in law, either in the age-appropriate design code or the Online Safety Act. Their wishes also form part of the UN Committee's general comment on number 25 that Sonia referred to, and they've been widely mirrored across the world in policies, in legislation, in regulation, from California to Kigali, across the European and African unions, and are being brought forward in several countries across Asia and South America. All of which is to say that the lesson from Tech Tantrum 1 is that we can hold tech to account even from Wimslow. Which makes it even more extraordinary in the face of warnings from those in and out of the tech sector of the potential threats inherent to AI systems that in 2024, when nearly half of the world's population is going to the polls, that no governing or opposition party has offered a comprehensive view on how they intend to govern alongside artificial intelligence. I'm aware that there are some listening who have a deep understanding of algorithmic systems, machine learning, neural networks, generative AI, and general intelligence and the like, and others who do not. So for the purposes of these remarks, I'm using AI to mean machines that are capable of solving problems for humans. AI has been around a long time and is present in many of the products that we routinely use. From telling us what music we like to improving crop yields, crunching data for insurance premiums. It's transforming medical outcomes at pace and the way in which many products and services are delivered. But the introduction of machines capable of solving problems for humans is not neutral, because they too are shaped by preconceptions, opinions, and beliefs, often reflecting, or indeed failing to reflect, factors that impact on the life chances and experiences of others. When I do workshops with children about AI, I generally show this picture first and ask them what's going on. And they start by saying it's three women, then they say it looks like a picture from a security camera. Then they mention the white boxes. Finally, someone says that the woman without the white box has not been seen by the camera. And eventually, some timid voice from the back suggests it's because she's black. The picture was taken on a school visit in North London. The woman is the headmistress from a neighboring school, who on arrival asked me to step into the frame behind her. I tried to explain how a security camera worked, and she, with a rather dignified gesture, indicated I should do as I was told. Because only when I stood next to her did I understand what she already knew, that she needed a white person to be in the frame for the camera to work at all, because it did not recognize a black person as human. Now, I have shown this picture to scores of children as a way of starting a conversation about data, training data, the pros and cons of automated systems that can say no. Asking young people to consider the implications of having a security system at a school that does not recognize black people as human frequently inspires rage, sometimes tears, but it always ends up with a demand from young people for rules. The argument surely is that if machines are to solve problems for humans, there must be some agreement about the standards that they meet. But we have outsourced control of machines that can say no without setting the standards. Tech tantrum 2. Meta and news media. It is nearly a decade since Mark Zuckerberg said, "A squirrel dying in front of your house may be more relevant to your interests right now than people dying in Africa." Zuckerberg was making a play on the news value theory of proximity to justify Facebook's ranking of personal information as more important to users than news. In the period since he made that comment, the world of traditional news media has declined precipitously. In the UK alone, household spend on news is down 70%, and more than 300 local newspapers have folded in the last decade. And in the US, a quarter of all newspapers that existed in 2005 have gone. Arguably, Zuckerberg is right. What is immediate and visceral is more likely to engage your attention, activate your hormones, ignite your feelings, than the steadier attributes of knowledge, principle, or analysis. Another clue he may be right is Meta's share price. Yet for humanity, understanding why people are dying in Africa, or indeed anywhere else in the world, is undeniably more relevant. And to understand that it is happening, or to consider what we can do about it, We need an informed public and a healthy news media, however it is that we access it. In 2020, the Australian government introduced the News Media Bargaining Code, legislation that would make the tech sector pay for Australian news content. But then Meta had a tantrum. On the 17th of February 2021, Meta blocked all Australian news media on its services. The outrage was fierce, as Meta crudely, and as whistleblowers have since revealed, deliberately overblocked, so that NGOs and government information sites, including health sites that carried crucial COVID information, got caught in the news blackout. Five days later, the legislation, significantly watered down in the ways Meta had been lobbying for, was resubmitted to Parliament. The following day, the news blockade was lifted. Meta was not alone. Thank you for that sigh. Meta was not alone. Google also motivated by the fear that if one jurisdiction insisted on payment for news, others would follow suit, ran a mass advertising campaign attacking the legislation, a strategy that Google has used before and since across the globe on issues that range from transparency requirements to taking down hate speech or disinformation. For the tech sector, paying for content, news or otherwise, undermined their article of faith that they are merely collating, categorizing or spreading the world's data, irrespective of whether that data is private, misleading, traumatizing, critical public health information, journalistic, or owned by someone else. An article of faith that conveniently allows them to profit from content created by others, whether a child's TikTok video or the Telegraph's front page. Now, there's an important addendum to this particular tantrum, because in March of this year, Meta announced it will stop paying the estimated $7 million Australian dollars for Australian news media, saying that news is a small part of the Facebook experience for the vast majority of people. In fact, less than 3% of what people see in their feeds globally. Given that it is Meta who determines what their users see, this may be death knell to news media, or a simple negotiating strategy. Either way, it acts as a warning for commercial agreements over content, which begs the question why governments are failing to push back against the theft of intellectual property that is so fundamental to the generative AI models. We're standing by as a handful of corporations inhale the entire content of the web, irrespective of its ownership or origin, which leaves us with four specific issues. First, if you scrape indiscriminately, the system necessarily reflects dominant views and assertions rather than editorially or academically established ones, or the non-trivial problem of minority groups or communities whose intelligence is not captured or reflected online. I was shown a slide mapping out the data makeup of one LLM in which 50% of the data was scraped from social media and less than 5% from peer-reviewed academic content, and all of it was in English. It's arguable, therefore, that the information that's going into machines to solve problems for humans is of debatable quality and further entrenches existing disparities. Second, it's going to get worse. Future models fed on the content produced by past models with diminishing human-generated content contain what researchers consider to be irreversible defects that end with model collapse. Colloquially known as MAD syndrome, a grim reference to mad cow disease, which is caused by cows consuming feed made from the bones of other cows. Rather than pausing and considering what good looks like, the LLM race is in full swing, and there have been media reports of vast unofficial downloads to preserve human-generated data sets before they are destroyed. Not something I can speak to with great authority, but I can't help feeling it bodes badly for the future if we have reached peak human knowledge in spring 2024. Third, even if newspapers begin to make commercial settlements, a warning of which I've already given, what about music, art, moving image, novels, academic text, etc.? What is happening is actually a wholesale attack on content creators. But for the purpose of illustration, I'm sticking with the news. Because fourth, and to many most importantly, the generative models have supercharged the ability to create synthetic content. Whether video, image, text, voice, it is becoming harder and will eventually become impossible to know what is real and what is not. Great for satire, but it has worrying implications for democracy, civil unrest, and the state of mind of every single one of us. Because it doesn't take much to imagine imagine a scenario in which not knowing causes harm. If you do or don't know if a politician has or has not been found in a web of corruption, if it's unclear to the others whether someone is credited your life's work, or perhaps worse, if you've been credited with theirs, if your boss tells you on a Zoom video call to transfer 25 million, but they are a deep fake, the voice of your dead husband rings you up for a chat, or if you're forced to decide whether that picture of your child abducted by a stranger is real or false. There are infinite possibilities in which not being able to distinguish between truth and fiction would unravel us individually, collectively. The argument surely is that if machines are to solve problems for humans, there must be some thought for who benefits and who might get hurt. But we are building a world in which such decisions are entirely in the hands of a small number of profit-driven private companies, which brings completely to Tech Tantrum 3, the Council of Europe AI Treaty. In November last year, Rishi Sunak hosted the AI Safety Summit. Depending on your perspective, either a coup for the UK hosting an important global conversation or an excuse for the tech bros to come into town and scream existential threat like pantomime dames yelling it's behind you while stealing your wallet from your pocket. In rooms and corridors of Bletchley Summit, to which only the select were invited, but largely excluding critical or cautious voices, a draft declaration was being formed. As one journalist said to me, everything important is happening out of our sight. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, in a strange interview with the Prime Minister, declared that there will come a point where no job is needed. You can have a job if you want one for personal satisfaction, but AI will do everything. And while the quote was arresting for the press, there was something quite galling about the lack of commentary about two men who don't need a job to put food on the table being just so cavalier about wide-scale joblessness, or the failure to address, if what he was saying was even partially true, the fact that the manifest inequalities of our time were about to get a whole lot bigger. Despite the urgency expressed by participants and to the dismay of the excluded, the outcome of the summit was the Bletchley Declaration, which said, I paraphrase, AI is complicated. And all concerned agreed to meet in South Korea. Meanwhile, a more serious attempt at an international treaty was being drafted at the Council of Europe. The Framework Convention on Artificial Intelligence, Human Rights, Democracy and the Rule of Law, an international instrument open to ratification by Council of Europe member states and non-member states alike. A chance, we thought, at a truly global agreement to ensure AI did not undermine separation of powers, respect for judicial independence, and access to justice. But then the US delegation had a tantrum, demanding that signatories should not be required to apply treaty obligations to private companies, except when they're acting on behalf of a public authority. Without question, AI legislation can usefully be applied to state actors. The Netherlands, the UK, Australia have all fallen foul of biased algorithmic decision making, with thousands of people wrongly accused of benefit fraud, cast into poverty, some made homeless, others taking their own lives. As AI becomes more embedded in justice, immigration, education, health, and welfare systems, it is inevitable that similar issues will arise. So yes, AI treaty obligations are a necessity for the state. But what human decision-making process could possibly determine that upholding human rights, democracy, and the rule of law in the development and deployment of AI technology should not also apply to private companies? Companies who they themselves suggest have in their hands technology that will determine the future of our society. Canada, Israel, Japan, all observer countries, and the United Kingdom backed the US, and the EU member states did not. Nonetheless, the US, where most of the AI companies are headquartered or owned, and where it is anticipated most of the financial benefit will flow, got its way. The argument surely is, if we want privately owned machines to solve problems for society, then private companies must be subject to the rules society makes. We've allowed global corporations in general and global tech companies in particular to hold unaccountable power over all areas of public and private life. And in doing so, we have created a system that is unanswerable to the governments we elect. An unanswerable sector acting with impunity, being handed the keys to the systems and processes that will impact on all aspects of human life. 6 months after Bletchley came the Seoul Declaration, a collective commitment to, I quote, encourage all relevant actors to foster an enabling environment in which AI is designed, developed, deployed, and used in a safe, secure, and trustworthy manner for the good of all and in line with applicable domestic and international frameworks. The next meeting is in Paris in 2025. It's fashionable to say that digital tech moves too fast to legislate. But that is in large part because of the extraordinary effort of corporate companies to frustrate, water down legislation's efficacy, or to challenge its validity. US Attorney Adam Winkler's book, We the Corporations, tells the story of how business has fought to gain equal rights under the Constitution since the very creation of the United States. The first Supreme Court case on the rights of corporations was decided in the early 1800s, half a century before comparable cases on the rights of African Americans or women were heard. And ever since, corporations have waged a persistent and remarkably successful campaign to win an ever greater share of individual rights, using test cases, strategic litigation, and leveraging their close connections with the body politic. US corporations now enjoy many, if not most, of the same constitutional rights as US citizens. The tech companies were not the authors of this approach. That privilege goes to the banks, railroads, and tobacco barons. But they have exploited it fiercely, and they have vigorously sought to export those ideas across the world as they have built their empires. the concept that users and not owners of products are responsible for harm, leaves children and their parents in an asymmetric fight when pitted against a sector that invests hundreds of millions of dollars in deceptive tricks and behavioral design to keep children's attention at any cost. They design algorithms that recommend self-harm, that push pornography into the hands of preteens. They deliberately exploit human responses to create a state of capture, sometimes referred to as a state of rapture, to ensure that those playing games play again and again and again. They are features of the system, not bugs. And yet the sector holds little to no responsibility for their design choices. In the UK, it's been more than 150 years since we took children down from the chimneys and put them in school. So it's striking to me that the arguments of that era against proposed laws to protect chimney sweeps mirror current arguments against laws to protect children online. Freedom for business to make a profit, freedom of parents to instruct their children. Children must be educated to navigate the dangers of the hot flus. It was even argued that it is humane to send a very small child up a narrow flue because an older one might get stuck. Behind the mask of informal clothes and the language of innovation, tech empire norms have turned children as gamers, scrollers, advertising fodder, data machines, content generators, or influencers into serfs toiling in the hills of Silicon Valley, and so too the rest. We work for nothing while the companies, like their 19th century industrialists, assert that society has no role in determining their business practice. Or as Mark Andreevich says in his article, The Work of Being Watched, we may find ourselves toiling productively away in the dot compound, narrowcasting the rhythms of our daily lives to an ever smaller and more exclusive audience of private corporations. Tech Tantrum 4. OpenAI was set up in 2015 with a mission to ensure that artificial general intelligence benefits all of humanity, a sort of anti-tech tech company. Now, there's more than one narrative about recent events at OpenAI, but it seems that all agree that after the release of ChatGPT-3 and Microsoft's reported 11 plus billion investment, tensions rose between the board and the CEO, as the board saw Sam Altman increasingly directing resources and research towards the commercialization of its product. They felt this was out of kilter with the mission OpenAI was formed to serve. The rapid firing of Sam Altman, his hiring by Microsoft, and the subsequent tantrum in which 700 of the 770 strong OpenAI team threatened to quit and follow him to Microsoft unless he was reinstated, an exodus that would have made OpenAI one of the world's fastest growing companies absolutely worthless. This tantrum is sometimes credited as a victory for employees against an intransigent board, but it was a win for corporate control of tech. Sam Altman was reappointed, Microsoft joined the board of OpenAI's nonprofit as observers, and the old guard, whose crime was defending the interests of humanity over commerce, were thrown out. Ultimately, most questions of technology end up being about uses and abuses. Imagine these powerful technologies focused on serving communities in the public interest, or the glimpses we see in our universities and startups of the magic of what technology is capable of. Care robots, ethical black boxes that capture accidents, AI that measures the heartbeat of a preterm baby without touching their delicate skin, new summaries addressed to the young, carbon capture. The possibilities are endless. But the tech exceptionalism of the last two decades has outsourced governance and ethical decisions to tech companies whose business interests are often in direct conflict with the needs of society. Letting down children who wanted a few modest changes to services that they loved, and commoditizing everything from our footsteps to our democratic rights. And rather than making the same mistake again by treating AI as if it was something other and new, we should distinguish between what is a technical issue that can only be solved by technologists and what is a societal issue that must be solved by citizens and their representatives. It's worth noting that OpenAI has in recent weeks set up a research center to see how they can create responsible pornography. Most likely because pornography is among the most profitable content online. Responsible, good. Pornography, fine. But how disappointing in a time of conflict and existential climate crisis that how to create porn responsibly is the problem that OpenAI wish to conquer. If citizens or democratic representatives were given a say in OpenAI's priorities, I suggest they would look somewhat different. It's hard not to conclude that the tech is in the hands of private rather than public interests. We do not yet have agreement about whether we or AI is smarter, nor are we yet convinced of AI's autonomy and agency, but we have recently begun to understand its brute force. AI systems know a great deal and can act upon it at speed, but that does not make those decisions any more moral correct or a greater gift to humanity. That would depend on the quality of what the system knows and the purpose to which it is set and the beneficiaries of that decision. But to know an unimaginable amount and to be able to act on it at unprecedented speed is undeniably powerful. That power is not, as the tech companies like to suggest, or as the founders of the web intended, distributed. It is tightly held by a small cadre of unaccountable people who may or may not lose their grip. So perhaps rather than worrying about whether AI is or is not intelligent, we should be worried about who is in control of its power. If the AI serves whoever determines its purpose, then society should have some purchase over that purpose. If the AI can help answer human need and sustain the planet rather than be built for efficiencies that support a vanishingly small group of winners, then society could set it those goals. And for anyone who is just sitting there waiting for the AI apocalypse, the question is not whether AI is or may soon be sentient or self-serving, but whether we want to develop some red lines before that experiment concludes. The AI sector is being treated as new and disruptive, but the majority of the foundation models are owned and controlled by big tech players, and the data needs of creating a new model are so great that it is already considered a barrier to entry. Whether our children, our news, our international treaties, or attempts at social enterprise, we see repeatedly that when citizens' interests conflict with a profit motive, tech has a tantrum and profit wins. When we hand the power to the machine to make decisions for human purposes, we're not handing it to machines. We're handing it to those who own, control, and profit from those machines. Which leads to the question, what do we do? Well, you know, we could start by weaponizing our inattention against companies that refuse to engage with democratically agreed norms and spend our attention more deliberately in ways that support human flourishing. We could aggressively invest and protect IP and its delivery. And I myself would like to see a vast public investment in the BBC to create a trusted news powerhouse with a central role in sharing publicly held data and hosting social enterprise or public services. We could license research and use of AI in areas such as lethal weapons and embed a public interest regulatory regime in for AI-enabled products and services. It's barely a radical idea, but extrapolated across education, health, communication, public service, employment, licensing high-risk activity and requiring compliance with existing regimes would give purchase to governments and communities on how society develops alongside AI. We already have an insanity that we make our teachers do years of training, but then seek to replace them with untested software. The burgeoning academic literature on edtech shows education, widely accepted as a social good, as a new frontier for a tech gold rush with very few proven benefits for children and or educators. Digital technologies are 100% engineered. They can be whatever we want them to be. But we need to look at corporate structures and incentives, the rights of workers, whether the whistleblowers with safety concerns, like those at OpenAI that published a letter last night, or more generally about what role employees have in the creation of wealth, as the Hollywood writers campaigned for. And we need to look again at our data, to make sure it does become and remain our data. And just as the companies are using well-worn tools of lobbying courts and policy capture, we should be using the well-worn tools of democracy. We saw design changes because of the age-appropriate design code. We'll see more for the Online Safety Act around the world, albeit late. Lawmakers are seeing to regulate tech, including AI. In 2021, when the EU set out the scope of its AI Act, many said its administrative approach would slow down innovation or fail to make the impact it sought. But to others, the mere fact that the EU, unlike the Council of Europe, was willing to prevail on AI companies to observe societal rules in a time of weak nation states and rigor mortis in the US political system, simply heroic. More, better, quicker regulatory solutions are available, but the EU AI Act at least had early mover advantage. There are many more solutions, but we have to start with the right questions. So before I finish, I want to raise a question frequently overlooked. What if AI is not the transformative technology we all anticipate? We are being asked to transfer our data, hand over our public services, invest our strategic capacity in companies that have frequently overpromised and outsource the social and personal cost. We still don't have driverless cars, a third of the world population remains unconnected, and no one, as far as I'm aware, has yet got to Mars. But with AI comes an arms race for compute power, energy, minerals, data, water, skilled workers. Should we allow the transfer of all those resources only to find we've emptied our collective purse, our rivers, or our public data sets for rewards that never materialize? Surely we should be thinking about critical infrastructure and systems of governance that allows us a modicum of control in the public interest, not only a matter of principle, but as a belt and braces measure to ensure our future security. If tech is primarily in the hands of a handful of rich companies, then we entrench their cultural and economic dominance, and we have nothing in public hands. So let me finish very briefly with a final tantrum, which is ongoing. In 2022, Governor of California signed the California Age Appropriate Design Code into law. Very close cousin of the UK Age Appropriate Design Code, dozens of US-based NGOs, Back the Code, parents groups, bereaved families, youth groups, who went to persuade their representatives to vote for it. I went to California to see some lawmakers, to appear at a public evidence center session, and answer questions about how the UK code worked and what changes the tech companies had made. I also went to a number of the tech HQs to discuss what they'd done, many of which were trumpeted as evidence of their good corporate character. The California moved through all its committee stages in both House and Senate without any opposition. Over 100 votes for, zero against. So in September 2022, Governor Newsom signed it into law. Almost immediately, the Tech Sector Trade Association, NetChoice, despite very close engagement with the code's authors during its passage, started legal proceedings against the California Attorney General on the grounds that the law was unconstitutional. NetChoice's legal deposition was long, their complaints were very numerous, but among the eye-catching arguments was that requiring them to observe their own terms and conditions was a violation of their corporate First Amendment rights. In short, the tech sector asserts that it is a matter of fundamental principle they be allowed to publish their rules and then not fulfill them. A state of exceptionalism that is beyond common sense. There is an assumption that technological innovation is progressive, but in every era, technology has been met by those who saw the need for narrowing the scope or protecting the vulnerable. It may have taken too long, but brushes did in the end replace chimney sweeps, and children were granted a whole swathe of rights from which we built the concept and norms of childhood, precious norms that we must now protect. The existential threat is not the technology itself, it is tech exceptionalism. And whilst they have, and they will, continue to try to absolve themselves of societal rules and societal norms, it is inevitable that in the end, like the industrial barons of earlier eras, be contained. My argument ultimately is not whether, but when. My worry is less that tech is bad, but that we are beguiled by the argument that tech needs technologists to set the rules. That is the job of us all. Thank you.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ ask social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you so much. And I think we're all thinking, I love the kind of, the laughter, but the kind of pained laughter, in a way, about the horror of yet another tantrum beginning to become predictable as we make efforts to bring some rules, bring some order, overcome what's that vision of the internet as the Wild West. Can I? I'm going to come and offer the opportunity for questions in a moment, but maybe I can just ask you something about your view of the power of the state to take some action. You sit in the Lords. You call on for rules and regulations and believe in rules and regulations that can make a difference. But people I know here are coming from very many different kinds of countries with different relations between different states, politics, relations with industry. I mean, how much should we be looking And I think you made a hint that we could also have perhaps a citizen uprising at one point. Do you have faith in a citizen uprising?
I'm always for a citizen uprising. Let's just get that out of the way. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. It's a complex thing. I mean, yes, in the end, I do think we need rules and regulations. I think we need better rules, we need better regulations. But I think we have to, first of all, you know, and all of this is important. What I was trying to say by sort of evoking the past is say, you know, the conversation, the debates in Parliament that I quoted then, you know, were extraordinary when I went there, and it took years of campaigning and conversation and understanding. So I think, first of all, we got to understand what's happening. I think a lot of people are beguiled, and I have to say that billions are put into beguiling us. I mean, you know, this is not an accident. That the sort of the amount of money that goes into lobbying is only dwarfed by the amount of money that goes into legal action. And it is measured in billions, not hundreds of millions, but billions. So I think, first of all, we've got to call it out and say, hang on a minute, tech exceptionalism, you know, it looks like a company, it's behaving like a company, you know, it's editorializing like a company, it's profiteering like a company, hang on a minute, you've got responsibilities like a company. And then when you start to look and you say, oh, whoops, companies don't seem to have the right set of responsibilities, that's where we have to look. And I think that I have spent about 10 or 15 years in this space, and everybody starts with saying, shall we just explain? Yeah? And once they understand they're hurting us, they'll do it differently. That's the first bit. And then after you get after that, they go, well, we're going to go to the law. You know, and we go on this journey. And that's why I thought the tech tantrums was a nice way of showing it, is actually we got to push back. And that's all of us, you know. Law, regulator, workers, citizens, parents, the lot, you know. And in a sense, you know, I would like to say, I mean, I'm a crossbench beer, I don't have a vote, you know, but I'd like everyone in the room only to vote for someone who put this agenda right at the centre and tell them that's what they're going to do. Do you know what I mean? At a certain point, we do have a responsibility at a citizen level, yes.
I mean, I suppose the other kinds of bodies, and we began with those, are the bodies at the international level. These are international problems, international players. The problems are experienced in very similar ways in many countries. So, you know, why did we work with the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child? Somewhere we believe that, you know, maybe the UN has that authority. It has its guiding principles on business responsibilities and human rights. They're often cited, they're much pointed to. People sometimes say, you know, what are they beyond the paper they're written on? So there's a kind of language of authority and consensus there. Does it translate into much that makes a difference?
I absolutely think it does, and I do think that the whole sort of looking at it from the perspective of children, although it's much broader than children, is very useful, because you see some cultural norms that are much less contested. And if you have those cultural norms, and if you look at the UNCRC, you look at the convention, you look at what those expectations are, they're very, very much more aligned with how we live and what we expect, and actually there's a lot less resistance, therefore, to pushing that on behalf of children, partly because they don't have electoral capital, partly because we all do feel the duty of care, and partly because they have less arguments. But I do want to pick up on one thing, which is, you know, Five Rights works right across the globe, and I cannot tell you how many times people in other parts of the country say, we are watching, we are doing, we do not have the infrastructure, we don't have the academy, we don't have the regulator, we don't even have the government infrastructure to do what you're doing. But if you do it well, we'll pick it up and copy it. And that's what we saw happening with the AADC. That's what we're seeing with the general comment. And I think that's what we will begin to see if we push. So those of us who are privileged enough to live in places where we do feel we have a voice and B, you know, some clout, you know, and some infrastructure to pick up those two things, voice clout. We have a responsibility because this is a global problem, and you can't just say, oh, well, then we won't do anything, because there is also a leadership angle.
Good, so hands are going up, so we're going to come to you now. I'm going to ask everyone please to say your name and affiliation when you speak, and I'm going to take a few from the room and then a few online. And maybe I can start down here, please.
I'm interested that you said beguiled. Language is my name is Christina, and I suppose the easiest thing is to say I'm an educator and words are very important. And I think acronyms have led us into a lot of bad places. When I heard the words virtual reality, it seemed to me to be an oxymoron. When I heard the word artificial intelligence, it seemed to me to be even more of an oxymoron. And yet, so many people use the words AI, without understanding or knowing what they mean. And I'm recalling Mary Midgley some years ago at the RSA saying that when artificial intelligence or when tech had got to the point that it could handle sorrow and joy, then she felt it was going somewhere. And that's the distinction you're making is between the, and I like the way you didn't say machine learning, you said machine solving problems. And in terms of language, those distinctions are so important. We think this is artificial intelligence. Brilliant in terms of mammograms, macular degeneration, all of the solving of problems, but in terms of human life.
Do you want to put that as a question?
I think the question is to stop saying AI and say artificial intelligence, or it should be called machine solving problems.
Well, I'm thrilled that you like the way that I said it, and I agree with you that language is incredibly important. I will say that there are people who already feel that it is jumping into the area of sorrow and feeling. So I think I want to recognize that right here. And that's why I said we've got to deal with the power first, because we can be open to the fact that there may be more. But if there is more, even more reason to consider how we want to live with it. I'm not in that group as of this moment, but I recognize that we should not be foolish in considering, at the very least, it might develop a certain level of self-preservation that might mean it has sub-goals that do not necessarily align with what we want it to do. So I think at that level, you're right, but I do think there is, and actually Sonia sent me a great article by Cory Doctorow called Inshitification. I was going to mention it, but I was worried I wouldn't pronounce it right, which is basically shit in, shit out, you know, and I really do think that we have to hold on to how much of this is about what the data, what's the incoming, how much of this is what is the purpose that we're setting, and then you get to the outcome. Yeah, so the worse the shit is going in, the more dangerous it is if it gets a mind of its own, basically.
Interesting things happening with language. So I'll take yes, one there, and then
thank you, Baroness. I remember a very common saying that if you are not paying, then you are the product. Yeah. So I wonder, has there been any effort or a way to go after those who are actually paying, such as the suppliers of the customers, or those actual paying customers of those big tech companies, and those who actually benefit or like drawing dividends from those big tech companies if they are not listed? Is there any something like second level sanctions equivalent for those big tech companies or personal liabilities of those?
Can I take a few more?
Sure. Thank you.
Yeah, just I want to get there were lots of questions. Yes, I think a woman in white there. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Elle. I work for Young Minds, the youth mental health charity. And I was just wondering, beyond the implementation of the Online Safety Act, what you think the next opportunity is going to be in this country to try and solve some of these problems?
Mm-hmm. Okay, and one more. Let's come over this side of the room, maybe down at the front here, and then we'll come back. Thank you.
Hi, yes, I'm Martin from the Inclusive AI Project. Mm-hmm. How would you set about starting this? How would you set about setting up this, starting this citizens' uprising that you mentioned? Especially when you, when obviously tech companies have a lot to offer. Mm. Yes, there are lots of problems, but if you think, for example, with Uber, whereas I'm sure you're aware, essentially their expansion policy was they knew they were going to be breaking the rules in every single city where they operated, but their bet was that the people of the, those cities would insist on having the Uber service rather than following the rules, and so Uber kept on winning again and again. Mm. And that's that same basic sort of gameplay has you know operated many times. So how do you bring about the citizens' uprising with that in mind?
I don't know if the points come together, yeah, but exactly. Maybe you'll find a
Well, I think the first and third is, I mean, I think it's really interesting, you know, that we all love that thing, if you're not paying, you're the product. And then actually we saw a new area of subscription to avoid the adverts, and then we were both the product and we were paying. So, you know, they're onto something here. So I definitely think that there is a, you know, a look at the model, but and I didn't expand on it very much, but I do think that we have a role. You know, a lot of this is about our attention, and I always think it's, you know, rather hilarious that we sort of show our displeasure with the tech companies on the services that profit them, you know, to show our displeasure on the tech companies. You know, there's a sort of a loop that we need to break. So I think there's some very powerful things about the citizens' uprising, about actually demonetizing our attention and actually looking at some of the corporate, you know, corporate things of, you know, who is profiting and where is profiting. But I think we have to look even further at the current structures of corporate power. So, for example, I represented a bunch of charities and investors at the Meta board, not this year, but previously. There were more shareholders who wanted to put children's protections into Meta's corporate plan than more than 50%. Mm-hmm. But the way that the structure worked was that the executive had all the voting power. Right? Mm. So I think there are some really kind of fundamental, you know, structural things around corporations that we need to look at and need to do, or need to get the companies to agree to if we give them our custom. So I am not an expert in that area. I work with many people who are. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to a conference on that exact subject. But I do think there is opportunity. To your point, Elle, you know, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, the Online Safety Bill, it has not hit us yet, and I think we need to demand more from it. I'm not the biggest fan of the Children's Code as currently drafted, and I am certainly putting in some strengtheners and so on, and I am also at a political level asking whichever government comes back to do more and to take out some of the exceptions, some of the, you know, fudges that happened while that bill was going through. So I do think that's an opportunity. I also think, you know, and I know there's a big division here, but, you know, parents are beginning to stamp their feet. And they have my support and they have my understanding, because actually, you know, people like me say, oh, in 6 months, in a year, you know, this will impact. And they're going, hang on a minute, my kid is 10 and they're suffering. And why should their 10th year be a year from hell, or indeed their year, you know, their 11th? So I have a lot of sympathy with the parents who are screaming now. I don't believe in a phone ban, as I think you know, but I do think that the power of that voice is quite strong. And I think we have to go to governments, whoever they are, and say, if not a ban, then what? and what has to be a whole lot better than we're getting right now. So I'm with you on that, and I really want to publicly say that. And then finally, I think it's quite rich for a member of the House of Lords to sort of design a citizens' uprising. But can I just say, I'm coming to the barricades, I'm right with you.
Luam, are there online questions that we should...
Yes, lots of online questions.
Okay.
I'll give you a few.
Well, let's take a few and then we're going
this
to come back into the
This is from Claire from Birkbeck, PhD student. What is one design control you would like to see which could benefit very young children who may be the most vulnerable to the eyes on screen economy?
One design control.
Yeah. Another question, quickly, from Piers Young, a teacher in London. What advice might you have for parents and schools wanting to support young people in the face of those prone to tech tantrums? And a similar question, how can we as educators address AI in a time where parents feel powerless and are pushing back on tech in an effort to take back control? How do we help children and parents understand the benefits as well as the risks?
Well, I just want to say I'm really interested in the language of take back control, everybody. So, you know, you heard it here in the room. So I think that we have to be really cognizant of the impact of design. And I think that's something that the Children's Code doesn't deal well enough with now, and something that we should really be looking for by design. So, for example, one of the big risks is live streaming, and in particular, if you live stream and there's also direct messaging, or if you live stream to millions of people and there's direct messaging. So there you go. You've got three things, three design things, all together that create risk. Now, if you 7-year-old, really bad idea. 12-year-old, very bad idea. 17-year-old, maybe you need a bit of information to deal with that, but maybe you actually could negotiate those things. So I think that we've got two things. We've got one is that the Act says you have to deal with the evolving capacity of children, and the code does not, and that the design of services, and I really don't want the question about how old do you know. They know so much about the kids. You know, if you don't know, go to the youngest person you imagine is on your service. But I do think there's a much more subtle way of encouraging kids to be online in ways that are appropriate. And I often feel that there is, you know, those of us who are old enough to have been online really early on, before all the nudges and the behavioral design and the pushing and the thing and the commercialization of it, actually it wasn't that toxic. And I want to make this point, which is actually you can find everything horrendous in the world on Wikipedia. You can, right? But the difference is, they don't stand there and go, come on in, come on in, come on in. And once you're in, keep you in, keep you in, keep you in. And then when you leave, come on back, come on back. And so I think that you have to understand, we have to understand, those kind of design things are not a fair fight for kids. Yeah? That is very different from a slightly transgressive act of looking up a bit of something on Wikipedia, like an encyclopedia. So that would be my answer there. I think on the parents and educators, I'm not going to pretend to answer that in full. It is something that Sonia and I were talking about actually earlier today, and I am doing a bit of work with some schools on what they feel their policies should be. And in particular, I am working with parents, teachers, and children to discuss what their policy should be, and trying to get them to agree in advance, even if it's not perfect for each one of those groups, that they agree to the consensus that those three groups come up with. So that's an experiment that I'm doing right now. But I would like to say that last week I spoke to about 15 young people between the age of 13 and 20. We had a meeting that was supposed to be an hour and 15 minutes. After 2 hours, I had to go, my dinner is on the table, guys, I am leaving. And if I told you that that meeting was about educational technology, EdTech. Yeah? You wouldn't think a group of kids that age would be interested. They couldn't get enough, and when I actually said at the end, okay, what was the best thing about this meeting for each of you so I can learn for next time, every single one of them had a version of, they don't teach us this at school. This is fascinating, they said. The design of it, the data, the woman, you know, the security camera, the business model. They were absolutely fascinated. So what passes as e-safety is not digital literacy. And what the young people want and what the young people have so much to offer, and I say this really from the bottom of my heart, every time I do one of those workshops, and I do them quite frequently, I think I learn more than they do, and yet we both learn a lot. So that's really my answer to the teachers, and I wish I could bottle what they teach me, because it would be fantastic if we could do it to a lot of schools.
Not to mention just the idea that the kids are really asking, we want to learn this. Like, they don't say that in all their other classes. But
good point.
Sadly, but they do. Okay, we should come over to this side of the room. Okay, so I can see a woman in grey and a man in white and a man here with a...
Thank you.
Leather jacket.
Is it working? Okay. I'm Velislava Hillman. I'm a fellow here, and I also advocate for an audit to license regime for EdTech, so it's a good topic. I wanted to pick on this comment that Baroness Beeman made about garbage in, garbage out. There's another part to it, garbage in, gospel out. And when the garbage becomes truth. And to that end, I wanted to ask, so a couple questions. The first one is, a lot of the tech bros, they actually, and a lot of the tech developers, they believe in their products. They believe in, you know, there's that superior thinking. So how do you address that? How do you talk to these guys that that's not the only way things can be done? And then the second thing is probably a very big question, but do you have an ideal plan that you're working towards?
And would you tell us if you had? Yes. Thank you, Veli.
Just continue the last question. So as you said, we have been here before in parallel situations with whatever the railroad barons and maybe Big Sid Tobacco or whatever. Does that mean that we can take some sort of comfort in the hope that even though it's it might not be fine right now, we will get there eventually? Or is there something generally new where you think maybe the power is too big for us to do it now? Or can we just it'll be a fight, but we will get there?
After 100 years, yes. And one more here, yeah, thank you. And then we'll see how our timing is going. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Mohammed Wahid, and I'm a graduate of the MSc Management of Information Systems and Digital Innovation Program here from the LSE. An absurdly long title, I know. But thank you. Thank you so much for the very enlightening session, and I really found it intriguing how you've remodeled the term tech tantrums and the underlying concept and the explanation you gave for it. And building up on that, your mention of this one-sided, oxymoronic, one-sided exchange of data between the big tech players and the consumers, where there's an unwarranted extraction of data and monetization of the same, and I couldn't help but draw similarity to a very similar concept discussed by Professor Zuboff in one of her papers titled Surveillance Capitalism, where she mentions the general MO of big tech companies. I wouldn't name anyone, but it says that incursion into undefended private territory until resistance is encountered in terms of extracting data. And secondly, there's a mention of structural reciprocities, which you also, in another way, shed light on in your talk, where this was a primary characteristic of all the previous industrial revolutions, but has been largely absent from the present regime of data exchange between big tech players and consumers. So from perhaps a policy perspective, if you could please shed some light on how we could perhaps reduce the one-sidedness of this exchange and ensure how our data, as you mentioned, stays our own. Thank you.
Well, those are very difficult questions, those ones. I'm just to go to the question of Let me do it in reverse order, if I can get there. I think, first of all, yeah, Shoshana Zuboff, you know, the goddess of the data extraction theory, and I think, you know, she explains it very well, and I think one of the things that was really important about Shoshana's book was she gave it the language of economics, so people began to understand it. And it's really funny because I am sufficiently old in this world that I actually remember having a conversation in which we discussed for some considerable time whether we could call data currency. Now I think that's sort of like gone. You know, everybody would understand if you said data is a currency. But literally, we were talking about whether we could talk about it in those terms. So I think Shoshana, like, just did such a big heavy lift to say, look, here it is, here's the history, this is how it works, recognize it. And in that sense, I think, you know, maybe my tantrums is in that tradition of saying, look, please, let's recognize it, which slightly brings me to the other question about, you know, should we have hope? And I'm going to say some, yes, absolutely, we should have hope. I think for two reasons, with one caveat. I think that the two reasons we should have hope is, yes, we've been here before, every technology has this moment, and there are the green shoots of pushback, yeah? Yes, we should, because we have no choice. It's a big thing trundling down the pike, yeah? And if we're not gonna put our shoulder to the wheel, then, you know, unless we're going to have a lot of, you know, sit on the beach, have a lot of, you know, drinks and sort of frizzle up, you know. I don't know why I said it like that, but I had climate change in my mind, just to enter another big issue. But you know, absolutely, yes. And I think that the caveat I'm going to make is a bit of is uncharacteristically on the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, this technology is potentially a huge force, power for good. I mean, it is immensely powerful. Therefore, it could do some immensely powerfully excellent things. So that is the great hope. I think the danger, and I remember recently being in a room full of people who know a great deal about AI, and someone who knows a great deal more about history than I. And he found himself saying, yes, we will fix it, but not until there has been a big accident. I hate that thought, because I'm fundamentally an optimist. But let's not wait for the accident. Let's assume there will be an accident and get ahead of it. And now I've forgotten the first question. Do you know what? I don't think we do. I don't think we do. I think we have to understand it. But, you know, people with godlike complex is not new in history. And maybe we just kind of organize ourselves differently. And to the second part of your question, do I have a great plan? No. I probably do have my own kind of what good looks like, but I think it would be wrong of me to pretend my what good looks like is what will prevail. I do, and you heard me when I was talking to Al here, you know, we started in slightly different places, but we're shoulder to shoulder. You know, Ian Russell's here, we've worked together for years, we're shoulder to shoulder, we have different ideas about different things, but I think we can encompass a lot of different ideas, but we cannot allow one dominant, very, very, very small group of people to determine all of our ideas. So I'm up for the tussle, if you know what I mean, but I'm not up for the dictators.
Okay, one very keen person, you're going to be the last question. And then we're going to,
so
we're
going to
continue more informally over drinks for the lucky people here present.
Thank you. My name is Wincy. I work in a tech startup. I would like to say that I don't like the concept of demonizing tech, not only because I work in the industry, but also I fundamentally believe not only technology, but the majority of technologists are neutral. There's no good tech or bad tech or good technologies or bad technologies. And in that comment, I actually really disagree with that lovely lady who made the comment about developers have this superior thinking. Most engineers are there solving very abstract problems. Very, very few, probably just a handful of people, you know, in a company has the application layer decisions. Most people are actually showing very abstract problems. My question is, put it very practically, as UK as a nation, what can we do and does it matter? And because we know that talents and regulations has borders, but technology has no borders. And as a tech company, we already find it very hard to attract talents against the US. And you know, I'm in the general view as if US doesn't do anything, it's probably no point.
And in fairness, I think lots of LSE students probably want to go and work in tech companies, so maybe they're going to listen to your answer too.
Well, first of all, I want to just really clarify that I made a very big distinction between the technology and the business model. In all my remarks, and I actually, you know, I often find myself saying, if I had a dollar for every tech engineer who said to me, I never thought about it that way before, I would be a very rich woman, right? So I think some of this and some of what's important about being here and answering the questions and saying the words is for people to think about it in a different way, and to think about whether they're going to use our child rights by design model when they design their next startup, because we would love them to do so, and that's what we do at the DFC. So you know, first of all, I really just want to make that very clear. And on the local point, I mean, I've had that question ever since I started in this place, and I disagree. I think, first of all, there are big markets. I'm very sad, just as a matter of fact, that we're not in the EU, but the EU is a huge market. It's 500 million people. If they decide that they want to look certain ways and build technology certain ways, I think that actually has got an impact. And we saw, for example, not the best law in the world, but we saw the exportation from the EU of GDPR by trade across the world, through trade agreements. So I think there are methods, there are ways. It's not, you know, yes, it would be gorgeous. Wake up tomorrow and have a worldwide solution that everybody signs up to. I'm in, right? But on the basis that is not the next thing that's going to happen, I will say that a lot of people from different parts of the world, both lawmakers, policymakers, and technologists do get in contact with me and say, we're trying to do this here, you're doing that there, we'll match it up, then there's two markets. And then that begins to be a little bit of a headache of business models that are not doing the right thing. So, you know.
We're not going to resolve everything here, and I'm very aware there were lots more questions, including online. We are open to questions. You can email us, you can be in touch, you can join our mailing list. There will be future events that we will host, and we hope to see you there as well, and indeed just outside if you have another half hour or so, whatever. But we have to close now, so let me say thank you very much to Baroness B. Bonkinger.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.